Welcome to Role Playing History, the podcast where we explore the history of role playing games. I'm Wayne Davis, and I'll be your guide for today's tour. Episode 98, Earth Dawn. This week we cover a game that's been through as many editions as it has publishing companies, but it has developed such a loyal and dedicated following that it has managed to stay relevant for more than 30 years. That game, as I just said, is Earth Dawn. Earth Dawn is a fantasy role-playing game. Plain and simple. There, show's over. Nah, you know me, it can't be that simple. Earth Dawn, while similar to D&D, draws most of its inspirations from RuneQuest and games like it. Its rules are bound to what's been described as magical metaphysics, which we'll explain a little later on. It also focuses a ton of detail on its setting, which is a trend that ran through the 90s and into the early 2000s, and is still noted in games from time to time today, though not nearly as often as it was at the time. So let's crank up the tour bus and break down the game. Earth Dawn was designed by Greg Gordon in the early 1990s as a prequel to Shadowrun, mirroring Shadowrun's returning magic after it had been gone for some time. And for the better part of 8 years, that remained the case. However, once FASA licensed Shadowrun to another company in 2001, the link between the two games was basically severed. But I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself here. The first edition of Earth Dawn was fruitful, as more than 20 different supplements were produced to support it, and most of them were positively received by the gaming public. It should also be noted that during this period, FASA went outside the game and licensed several novels and short story anthologies to be published, and those sold moderately well also. Despite Earth Dawn's success, FASA decided to shut down the production of the game in January of 1999, citing budget cuts as the primary reason. That being said, they shortly thereafter came to an agreement on a license for Living Room Games to produce new materials for the game. And the key word there is new materials, so nothing that had been previously published would be republished. Living Room Games then did what I would call the smart. They took their time working on Earth Dawn before they released their second edition. I say that's the smart because we've seen dozens of times on this show that a company picks up the license for an already established game, then hurries a new edition to press only to have the entire endeavor fall flat. So, taking one's time to work out the proverbial kinks is definitely the smart. The designers at Living Room didn't make many changes to the overall setting. Their focus was on updating the timeline as well as making some rules adjustments. Among those were altering some of the classes from first edition to, as they put it, allow for more well-rounded characters and better balance of play. The second edition sold fairly well and garnered decent reviews. Living Room Games continued to publish this version, as well as supporting materials for it, until they lost the license in 2005. But let's back up a couple of years for what I'd call some unusual shit. In 2003, FASA handed out a second license for Earth Dawn as a role-playing game. Red Brick was the recipient this time, and while the deal was originally for their own edition, it also included a reprint of the first edition of the game in PDF form. Those books were released as the Earth Dawn Classic Players Compendium and Earth Dawn Classic Game Masters Compendium. Both books clock in at a beefy 524 pages and have been designated by many in the game world as an alternate second edition of the game. It's not a true second edition, as everything in these versions is directly compatible with the originals, but it's just different enough for some to consider it another version. Sort of how D&D had 3.0 and 3.5, or the fact that Pathfinder First Edition was basically D&D 3.75, but I digress. Writers at the time noted that the reason these books were larger than the originals is because Red Brick gave each of the disciplines in their game their own chapter, as well as providing extensive coverage of the Barsive setting, which the original gave a decent amount of coverage in its own right, but it didn't have this much. And before you ask, no, you can't find it in PDF anymore, and the reason will be clear in a moment. By the way, Red Brick also released a new line of Earth Dawn novels in 2007. But the main event was the release of 3rd edition in 2009. Writers have noted over the years that while Red Brick made every attempt to stay true to the vision and style of FASA's product, they just couldn't help themselves and revised just about everything about the game, adding new materials to fill in the gaps their revisions created. Red Brick was so confident in their new version, they decided to shoot for a much larger audience than they'd be able to get on their own, so they made a deal with Mongoose Publishing to have their imprint, Flaming Cobra, publish and release the book for them, and the first two books in the line came out in 2009. Red Brick kept plugging away at their third edition, as well as the PDFs of the classic materials, but the ride came to an end for them in 2012 when Red Brick went out of business. The Earthdawn license reverted back to FASA, and the story would continue. FASA announced in 2014 that they were launching a Kickstarter to produce and release the fourth edition of Earthdawn. This new edition has been described as a tightening of the rules, reworking of the game mechanics, tossing out of redundancies, and simplifying the success level system. It also advanced the game world 5 years so that dangling threads from previous editions could be passed over and/or dealt with. Along with this announcement, it was also announced that Impact Miniatures had received permission to begin production on the old Heartbreaker Hobbies and Games official Earthdawn miniatures. It was an extensive line, and Impact got on their Kickstarter immediately as well. Needless to say, both Kickstarters were quite successful, with the first title in the 4th edition line, The Player's Guide, coming out in early 2015, and the first run of the minis coming out shortly thereafter. While FASA maintains the license for Earthdawn to this day, they did grant Vagrant Workshop a license in 2016, and Vagrant decided to do something a little bit different. They released what they titled the Age of Legend edition of the game with what they called a Rules Light mechanic, which means they used the freeform Universal RPG system. Vagrant marketed this version as being, quote, ideal for one-shots, convention games, and introductory games, even for kids, end quote. If you're interested in picking up a copy of Earthdawn for yourself, you can check your local game shop or bookstore, or FASAGames.com for the standard version, or Noble Knight Games at NobleKnightGames.com for the Vagrant version, as Vagrant went out of business a few years back. With the history covered, let's take a look at the setting, which is extensive. That being said, we're only going to scratch the surface of it, so I'd refer back to what I said mere seconds ago if you're interested in checking out the full deal. Earthdawn is set in Barsive. It's been noted that magic there goes through cycles, which, if you think about it, is pretty much how everything goes. However, in game terms, this means that as the magic level rises, alien creatures known as horrors cross over from their otherworldly dimension and into ours. For the record, horrors come in all shapes and sizes. Some are what are called simple eating machines. They basically just devour any and everything they come into contact with. On the other end of that spectrum are the highly intelligent types that feed on the negative vibes they promote in their prey. So, lawyers, politicians, and bill collectors, right? Nah, I'm just kidding. I like lawyers. As long as they're not rules lawyers. In Earthdawn's distant past, an elf scholar founded what's called the Eternal Library because he'd figured out the time of the horrors would be upon them soon, and he needed a way to find the means to deal with them, either by defeating them or, at the very least, ensuring that they could be survived. As we've come to expect from our fantasy worlds over the years, a community developed around the library, and it created wards and protections against the horrors, then traded them with other lands around the campaign world. This led to the area becoming the Theron Empire, which was powerful and exceptionally advanced magical civilization. They're also the main antagonist of Earthdawn. The people of Thera built underground towns and cities they called Carers, then used those Theron wards to seal them off, with the idea being they'd just ride out the time of horrors, which became known as the Scourge. Now, they weren't complete assholes about this thing. They did warn most of the nations around Thera that the horrors were coming, and they did offer Carers to those who were interested. That being said, they did pull the asshole move of making the offer contingent on those nations pledging their loyalty to the Theron Empire. Of course, there were those who saw the deal for what it was and agreed to it, knowing full well they weren't going to hold up their end of the bargain when things were said and done. I mean, who wants to willingly commit themselves to tying themselves to the bureaucracy and political conflict and virtual slavery? Yeah, well, shit. Anyway, the scourge ended after 400 years, and folks emerged into a world forever changed by the scourge. And that's where the players come in. Their characters are exploring this new world, as well as dealing with any horrors they run into that are still around. Now, I alluded to it earlier, but the primary setting of Earthdawn is Barsive, which is a former province of the Thean Empire, composed of a number of city-states that have been independent of the Empire since the Dwarves of Thrall led the rebellion against Thera. Whew, we've said a lot about the setting without really digging into it, so let's break down some more stuff. I mean, we've got the time, obviously, so why not use it? I mentioned moments ago that Barsive used to be a Theran province. Now it's a collection of city-states, and here's how it breaks down. Kingdom of Thrall is a monarchy controlled by the dwarves. Yelpos is an autocratic city-state. The Bloodwood is a monarchy controlled by the elves. Kratos is a kleptocracy and city of thieves. Europa is a very important port and also happens to be a city-state. Jerris and Trevar are both also city-states. You've got the troll clans in the mountains, and they are raiders of the other lands, naturally. You've got the Tiskrang clans, or Aropagai, of the Serpent River, and they operate as traders. Vivain is a city-state, but it's currently occupied by Thera. Haven and Parlaenth lie in ruins. That's thanks to the war. There are great dragons out there, and there are also a number of secret societies running around doing all their super secret shit. So with that covered, let's look at the provinces of the Theran Empire so that we're being fair and balanced. Kriana is south of Barsive and is ruled by a living passion called the Pharaon. It's got horror-corrupted mummies running around as well, so there's a good time to be had by all. Endrissa is the newest province of Thera, and it's got a lot of resources and culture that make it a perfect fit for the Empire. Marok is a place where science is considered magic, and it's treated as such. Travelers to Marok should be warned that at present there's a bloody revolt going on known as the Jannari Rebellion, so be careful. Rugaria is to the far north of Thera, and it's one of the oldest provinces, which means it has that old man get the hell off my lawn vibe. Thela is full of dukes and kings, which makes it a political intrigue soup. Vasgothia is the most western province of the empire. This is the top crop producer, but also has a ton of savage tribes that are, as you might expect, anti-empire. There are lands outside of this area that might come into play during the campaign, but I think I'll leave those for you to check out on your own. Let's move on to the various races of the Earthdawn game. You've got your humans, dwarves, orcs, trolls, and elves, and they're all your typical races from fantasy literature and other fantasy role-playing games. The Obsidiman are a race of large, rock-based humanoids, standing in about 7 feet tall and weighing in about 900 pounds. The Tiskrang are lizard-like amphibious humanoids with long tails. They're also considered to have a flair for the dramatic. One of my sources said they had the attitude and presentation of the swashbuckler, so there's a visual for you. The Windlings are small, winged humanoids. Closest example I found in my research were the Fae, so think smallish elves with wings. Leafers are sentient plant people and are native to the dark forest of Vasgothia. Ulkmen are basically humans merged with horrors. Despite that, they're mostly peaceful and are also native to the dark forest of Vasgothia. Jabruk are half-human or orc and half-elemental spirit, and are the only half-race in Earthdawn. They're native to the Sulfic tribes of Marak. Jackalmen are native to Kriana and have the body of a human and the head of a jackal. They're warriors who are believed to practice cannibalism. Sounds like fun. Let's talk magic. The magic of Earthdawn is a varied system, no doubt. But the essential idea of it is that all player characters, who are known as adepts, have access to magic, and it's used to perform abilities attained through their disciplines. Each discipline has a unique set of talents, and those are used to access the world's magic. Legend points, which are the Earthdawn analog for experience points, can be used to up the character level of the talent, which increases the step for the ability, which means, in short, they're more proficient in that type of magic. There's a whole lot more to this. But now that I think about it, I think it's another item best left for you to check out for yourself in the book. Again, if I told you everything, what incentive would you have to go buy the book, right? So let's break down the mechanics of the game. It needs to be said up front that this is a very unique way of handling skill tests. When a player wants to do an action, they have to determine their level or step for the skill, talent, or ability to be used. They then look up the level on the chart of dice to be rolled. So you use the step you need and you roll the dice. The results are added together, with max results on either die being re-rolled and added to the total, and then it's compared to the value, which is determined by the GM based on the difficulty for the task. Basically, it means this. It's possible to succeed with a lower step number and possible to fail with a higher one. It's a system that can, on occasion, make combat last a lot longer than in other games of its type as well. And concerning those steps, I'm going to refer to the classic version for the dice since they were adjusted in subsequent editions. The lowest step, step 1, has the player roll 1d4 and subtract 2. Step 10, which is around the midway point, is 1d10 and 1d6. You add those together, you don't subtract. Step 19, which is the highest, is roll a d20 and 2d6 and add those together. The dice increase as you go up the scale, obviously, which leads me to believe that the higher the step, the greater the chances of success, regardless of what I just said a few moments ago. But then again, I've been wrong before. Now, the Age of Legend edition of the game does something different, and I wanted to point it out here. It uses a D6 for all rolls and is based on a yes, no, and but system. Here's how it works. 6 means you get what you want and you get a bonus. 5 means you don't get what you want, but it's not a complete loss. 4 means you only get what you want. 3 means you don't get what you wanted. 2 means you get it, but it comes at a cost. 1, as you would expect, is the worst. It means that not only did you not get what you wanted, but things got worse. Truth be told, I think I like this one better, especially from a pace of game and storytelling angle. And with my head spinning from the mechanics, let's hit a couple of reviews. Chris W. McCubbin reviewed it for the September-October 1993 issue of Pyramid. He said, quote, "Although it never becomes bogged down in cliches and avoids outmoded concepts, Earthdawn is, at heart, a very traditional heroic fantasy RPG," end quote. In the February 1994 edition of Dragon, Rick Swan did the honors. He praised the high production values and called it, quote, "an easy read," end quote. However, he had his complaints, noting that, quote, "despite workable rules and a clever setting, Earthdawn is more frosting than cake, with little of substance to distinguish it from the competition," end quote. Overall, though, he concluded, quote, "in a greasy pizza, let's not take this too seriously kind of way, Earthdawn holds its own," end quote. And in the Arcane 50 Most Popular Role-Playing Games of All Time poll from 1996, Earthdawn came in at 24. Here's what Paul Pettengale had to say, quote, "very good indeed. Earthdawn combined traditional fantasy with Call of Cthulhu-style horror and a detailed background to create an evocative and interesting setting. Combined with a clear, well-designed rule system and an impressive range of supporting supplements and adventures, this is an excellent fantasy game," end quote. It should also be noted that Pyramid Magazine in 1999 named Earthdawn as one of the millennium's most underrated games. Scott Herring said this about the FASA version, quote, "Earthdawn had an original, inventive magic system and a game world that gave you the classic monsters and dungeons sort of RPG experience, but it made sense doing it," end quote. I think we've covered Earthdawn about as completely as we can, so let's bring this week's tour to a close. Next week, we dive back into D&D settings with a look at Al-Qadim and Khaura Tur. In the meanwhile, check out our other podcast, Bad GM's Campaign Build Along. This week, we finish off the job list for our group, then launch them into the next phase of the campaign. Bad GM's Campaign Build Along is available wherever you get your podcasts or on our website, badgmproductions.com. net. The music we use for this show comes from Pixabay.com. Check them out for all your license-free, royalty-free music needs. Role-Playing History is a production of Bad GM Productions. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/gaming/badgmprod. On Twitter at BadGMP. YouTube and Tumblr, it's Bad GM Productions. You can email us at badgmproductions@gmail.com. And online, the website is badgmproductions.net. Next week, it's Al-Kadim and Karatur, and I think it's time to give those settings the love they deserve. That's next week, though. Until then, I'm Wayne Davis, and you're role-playing history.